This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all senseless ties, is now born again into this world.
A simile that just popped into my head was with Buddhism. Obviously, the Buddha is the central point. So, I think in the West we have a bit of a chip on our block about religion. So sometimes it feels hard to talk about religion, but it's like everything grows out of the Buddha. There's one of the great disciples of the Buddha made a simile that the Buddha was like the roots and the trunk of a tree. And the disciples of the Buddha were like the branches and the leaves. So it's like everything grows out of the Buddha. And the Buddha was related as the kinsman of the sun. And then a practitioner was related like a cool full moon. So it's like you can imagine there's a radiant sun and there's the moon reflecting the light of the sun. So it's like everything that... All Buddhism really grows out of the teachings that the Buddha taught us. And that's useful to understand because in Buddhism, it's like the Buddha is a very rare being who dedicated his life to becoming a better person until he became a perfect Buddha. And when he recalled his past lives, I think 92 universes ago, he was a monk back then. And he was a naked ascetic practicing. And that was the time of six Buddhas ago. So in 92 universes, this is the sixth Buddha. So they don't come along very often. So the Buddha said, it's like I think I said this last week, like a blind tortoise poking its head up and managing to put its head into a yolk that's floating on the surface of the ocean. So there's this yolk somewhere on all the surface of the ocean of the world, and once every 100 years, a blind tortoise would poke its head up to the surface and happen to put its head through that yolk. That's how rare it is to be born as a human being and to hear the Dharma and then actually, you know, begin to practice. So it's pretty rare. and he said that, yeah, I think I said this last week as well, that it's like in one universe, if you gather together all the bones of all the bodies and somehow they didn't crumble away, then it would be enough to fill like a Himalayan mountain. So that's just one universe of past lives that we've had. And so that gives an idea. And then when he would talk about suffering, he said that we've filled the oceans. Like if you went back and started to look at our past lives, you could fill the oceans with our tears of how much we've suffered in previous lives. And because however much we practice, and then we have people that we love, and then when we die or before we die, we're parted from those who we love and we're parted from our possessions, and then so the Buddha is always pointing back to that this is kind of an impetus for us to focus on learning to be better people. So we learn to be wise and then be like the Ajahn Chah. As mentioned this last week as well, be like the bee that takes the nectar without damaging the petals. So if there's teachings, wherever those teachings are, you try and take what is good, but then you don't get angry at what you don't like. You know, you don't go, oh, why did they say that and do that? You just go, well, you know, thank you for the good and let go of the rest. Because we all have a lot of work to do in our lives, so we don't know where people are coming from. Or what's going on in their lives and the teachings that they have. So, yeah. But it is hard as a householder, because the Buddha compared living the household life that is crowded and dusty, where life gone forth is open and free. Because life gone forth, our lives are supported by generosity and we can focus our efforts on the teachings of the Buddha. Where when you actually, there's this great teaching where the Buddha was teaching Moggallana, which was like his left hand's disciple, and he was teaching him, when you go to people's houses and they invite you for lunch, then if they don't come and feed you and they're running around doing chores in their house, don't think, who put these householders against me? Because he said, you know, household life is busy. There's many chores to attend to. There's, you know, husbands and wives and businesses and children and all these things to attend to. So even if we go to a house and we get totally neglected, then that's part of life. Because it's not that those householders are meaning to do that. It's that life is busy. You know, you have to cook food. You've got to look after your family. And then you can forget that you've invited a monk and they're sitting and in your lounge room. So we shouldn't be puffed up in vain. We have to be like humble and accept the limitations that that householders have, and then also make use of the fact that the benefits that we have, and that's why we have certain things that we cannot do. We've called four parajikas. And because that would break the faith of lay people if we did these terrible things. And so there's a greater karmic consequence for our actions than there is for householders. And so part of Buddhism is you start to learn about cause and effect, which is the name for karma. And but a useful thing, way to look at karma is what you think you become. So you have to start looking at the mind. So So are we having good thoughts? Are we learning to be kind? And when we're going in the wrong way, do we notice that? And do we catch ourselves and say, actually, that's not very good. Maybe I should stop doing that. You know, even if we don't, like me, I was saying, being a bit greedy with food. And some of the medication that I take makes me a bit hungry. So I have to be extra vigilant around food so I don't get greedy. Because then if I get greedy, then I oversleep. And then if I oversleep, then I feel groggy and I don't want to practice as much. So it's like this knock-on thing. So we have to look at what... I think one of Ajahn Brahm's talks in 2014 or 15 was like, you have to pick your snake. So say there's some snakes in the grass, you can't deal with them all at once. So just pick one. So, you know, choose one thing in your life that you're going to try and work with. So then it doesn't become like massive, you know, just one thing and then another thing. And then if it all falls apart, then you start again and you just pick one thing again. And then so the meditation is when we take the time to calm our minds and then we use that power for bhavana, which is like learning to watch over our mind and be skillful. And I've been teaching at the prison up at Karnet Prison, just down the road, and just seeing one of the monks, one of the prisoners who's been organizing that group, from when he first came, and then I've spent a lot of time talking with him over that time, and he's really grown as a person, and now he's in this Big Brother program where he helps the prisoners who aren't fitting in, and he's encouraged other prisoners to come along to meditation. And I did it there many years ago, but just to see one person just kind of, you know, growing so much, and he's in a prison, and you know, really, really brought me a lot of joy to see how well he's doing in there. So yeah, don't think our circumstances limit us. We limit ourselves. You know, as you know, we're just down the road, but for some people living in a monastery can be a prison if you don't want to be there. So, you know, just learning to be friends with our experience and be honest with ourselves is a big thing. Yeah. So I was also speaking with the driver who was ringing me here today about mindfulness. So I think a part of mindfulness is just learning to be aware of what you're doing through the day, which can be hard in some circumstances. So you find ways of, like in Thailand, they have the word Buddha. So Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Man, all those teachers, what they would first teach their students was just say Buddha all day long. Don't do anything else, just say Buddha. So with your breath, through all your actions through the day, and then eventually your mind gets used to that, and then it's a way of staying in the present moment. And then another way is to be aware of your body postures. So you just become aware from inside out of your body, like what is my arm doing, where are my feet. So this recollections that bring you back into the present moment. Or when you're washing the dishes or you're driving the car, you just become fully aware of that experience and go, okay, I won't let my mind wander off now. If it does, I'll just come back and just be in the present moment with this particular activity. And then as time goes on, then you get to the point where you can go 20, you won't go 20 minutes in a day where you don't know where your mind is. And then what that means is that your meditation starts to become more continuous. So it's not like when you sit down to meditate every time you're back to square one because you've just let your mind run awash. But you actually get to the point where in those periods where you're focused on the mind, that then every meditation is kind of a deepening and you don't have that same kind of monkey mind jumping all over the place. But back to the monkey mind, just like you would never expect a monkey to sit still, never expect your mind to sit still. Because then you won't have any suffering, and you learn to deal with the mind as it is, and learn techniques to calm the mind and kind of lull the mind. And the simile of a great monk in Thailand, I listened to his teachings, Ajahn Thampudon. He said it's like there's a harsh wind and a soft wind. And so usually the way we want to deal with our mind is we want to be the harsh wind. And so the harsh wind will blow at the monkey that's holding onto a branch. And so the monkey will just hold on even tighter to the branch. But then the soft wind will kind of lull the monkey, and the monkey will barely even notice it. And then eventually the monkey falls out of the tree. And that's meant to be the simile for like deep samadhi, where the mind unifies inside itself. So the path is meant to be gentle and patient. So if ever we're getting caught up in the world, or finding we can't meditate and practice, just ask, am I being gentle? Am I being patient? And if you're being harsh and impatient, then the answer is no. And then the more we practice, we start to learn how to direct the mind to that gentle and patient. And then we see our triggers and we see our faults. And rather than getting too concerned about them, we just let go of them for now. And we gather the good things that we have. And so that's what we make a kind of a nest of. And one in the Terigata verses of the senior monks, they say it's like making snug, like a bird snug in the nest. So it's like we start to know our wholesome qualities, and then we're like a bird that's snug in the nest. We don't need many possessions. We don't need the relationships and things around us. We just have our own goodness, and that's enough. So no matter what happens to us externally in the world, we're not going to be moved by it. You know, it may initially cause us some distress, but then because we've been meditating and because we understand, you know, things are impermanent, we can just gather our good qualities and it becomes like a blanket. So we're like a bird that's snug in the nest. So that's the kind of way that we want to see things. And then a useful technique sometimes when you're meditating is to imagine that everybody in the world vanished or died. There was some apocalyptic plague and somehow you've just got enough food left to live, comfortable, but nobody else is alive. Because if that happened, then you were a meditator, then what would you do? You would probably just have to keep practicing, but you wouldn't have many problems because there'd be no people left. But that's a useful technique. Ajahn Chah would say that when you're in a room of people or you're meditating, then just imagine that you're there alone. You know, and or sometimes you may have external things. I used to, when I worked at the Submarine Corporation, I'd get the keys from the security guard and go sit in the shed sometimes, because they had like the mats that they would sit on, so the pile of mats. So if I worked a long day, I would grab his keys and go meditate in the shed at work. And so, but watching over the mind through the day and then finding little times to meditate 5 minutes here or there, then when you come to meditate again, even if you're only meditating once a week or once a day, then it's like you're keeping the kettle ready to boil. So you're keeping all the good qualities in line. So then when you come to meditate again, you're not starting again. Okay, well, let's do the meditation. Taking a few deep breaths. That's a useful technique. Any time in the meditation where it doesn't matter if there's people in the room, but if you find the mind starts thinking a lot, then you just take a few deep breaths. That's what Ajahn Chah suggested, and it's a very useful technique. So you can start the meditation, just let go of all tension, all anxieties, all thoughts. You might give the shoulders a rub. Make sure the body's in a comfortable position. Carry so much tension around. The start of meditation, useful just to relax the body. Relax the toes, the feet, the ankles, the lower legs, the knees. Relax the thighs and the whole legs. Imagine all tension draining out into the earth. Relax the waist. Relax the belly. Just become aware of the belly as it rises and falls with the breath. Natural sensation. Relax the lower back, middle back, the diaphragm and the solar plexus, the chest and the lungs. Just become aware of the lungs as they fill up and empty. It's a natural process. The rise and fall of the chest. Tuning into peace, tuning into relaxation. As the lungs fill up and empty, relax the upper back, all the muscles, the spine, the shoulders. I'd imagine the shoulders droop a little, completely unwind. Relax the upper arms, elbows, lower arms, wrists, hands, fingertips. In a comfortable position, draining out all the tension into the earth. Totally relaxing the torso and the arms, accepting and as they are. From the shoulders into the neck and throat, become aware of the breath as it passes through the pipes in the throat. Totally relaxing the neck and throat. Relax the chin, the jaw, the lips, around the lips, cheeks and cheekbones. under the nostrils. Nostrils, under the eyes, around the eyes, the eyelids, the eyes themselves. Totally relax the eyes, all the muscles of the eyes, all the tension of the eyes. Let it drain away, dissolve and disappear. Tingly, relaxed sensation. All tension vanishing. Relax the eyebrows, the temples, the forehead, the whole head, the whole body. This tingly sensation of relaxation spreading through the whole body. Relaxing the body, the eyes, and relaxing the tendencies of the mind to flow out into the world. Content to be here right now. The body needs to move in the meditation, just let it do what it needs. Allow the body to be relaxed and bring the attention to the mind, to the heart, to the rest of one's experience. Put down thoughts of the past. Put down thoughts of the future. Put down thoughts of the external present. And become aware of one's experience right now, the present moment. Like a bird snug in the nest. Gathering the good, not burdened with the world. Letting go of the world of sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touch and thought. Being content to be here right now. Learning to be upright but relaxed, gentle and patient, and here in the present moment, find the breath. Going in and going out, all on its own. Just find where the experience of the breath is most natural. Some people at the nostrils, some people find it in the upper lip. Some people at the belly, and some people find it permeates the experience. So usually you just choose one that seems suitable. and throughout the meditation period, you might find that the mind looks at other things, but then just notice the gentle coming back to the meditation. Gentle, like a friend. Breath comes in and out. Is the breath short? In breath short or long? Is the out breath short or long? This gentle, peaceful attention. There's an in-breath, there's one thing. The out-breath is another thing. Allowing each breath to captivate the attention. This tingly, soft relaxation. Heart and an upright mind, just with one in breath, just with one out breath, being okay with whatever is, not being proud and demanding in any nature, but humble and peaceful. Tuning into the feeling of the in-breath. Tuning into the feeling of the out-breath. Like on a hot day, we found the cool shade of a tree, easeful and peaceful. friendship with the in-breath. A heart of friendship with the out-breath. If you can be aware of the whole of the in-breath, the whole of the out-breath. Tranquil in breath, tranquil out breath. As the mind begins to brighten, be aware of a sense of ease and happiness with the in breath. Sense of ease and happiness with the out-breath. I'll be silent for the next 10 minutes. begin to see how the mind is after half an hour of meditation, how the heart is. See what has worked, how one has used one's attention, the feeling he sees happiness. So we can learn to become skillful. And for the last 5 minutes, last week we did a bit of metta, but tonight I thought we would do mudita, which is appreciative joy. And I'll just use a contemplation that I use for myself. Mudita is wishing beings joy, that they enjoy the results of the good karma, that it brings them joy to reflect on their good actions, and we celebrate in that joy. We wish this to other beings and ourselves, kind of a wholesome joy. Sadhu, sadhu, may all beings continue being joyful. Sadhu, sadhu, may all beings continue being joyful. May the great Brahma continue being joyful. May Brahma's retreat continue being joyful. May the great Sakha, God of the celestial beings, continue being joyful. May his company, the gods of 33, continue being joyful. May the arahats of the world continue being joyful. May all celestial beings continue being joyful. May all those with good intentions continue being joyful. May the kings and leaders of the world continue being joyful. May all those with little dust in their eyes continue being joyful. From the poor to the rich, from the angry to the benevolent, may all humans continue being joyful. May they make use of their good karma, enjoy the results, and be a source of more good actions. May all animals, noble animals, noble horses, noble elephants, the four royal snake families, and all other animals and insects, those on land and sea, may they all continue being joyful. May those yet to be born and those in the ghost realms and below continue being joyful. May all beings make use of their good karma, enjoy the results, and may it be a source of joy for their hearts. May all beings continue being joyful. May we ourselves continue being joyful. May we notice the good actions in our lives and gather them up like gems amongst the rough. May we be joyful for them. Generosity, kindness, all the good qualities in our heart, may we make much of them and rejoice in our good karma. Sadhu, sadhu, may all beings continue being joyful. Even beings we've had difficulties with, or beings that seem opposed to us, may we wish them well. This joy is like a happiness of the mind, with a sense of equanimity and peace. So So to even those beings who find difficult in this life, may we wish them to continue being joyful, that they notice their good actions, the results of their good karma, that they too may rejoice with the heart of mudita. Sadhu, sadhu. May all beings continue being joyful. That brings us to the end of the meditation. Have any final question? Did you like mudita? Have you done mudita meditation before?
No.
Anyway, I find with the Brahma Viharas, you have to practice them regularly. And then usually you start with metta. When the Buddha taught the Brahma Viharas, you start with metta and then compassion. So metta is benevolence, and then compassion, and then mudita, and then upeka. So it's actually a sequence. But mudita, I found, I've been practicing for about 3 or 4 years now. So it's one of my main meditations. So I recommend the Brahma Viharas because they give the heart some inspiration. So thank you for all coming today. Now let us chant the verses of sharing in aspiration.
Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nirvana. In every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind, with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge, unsurpassed is the tradition of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these,